I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I think that when I was growing up, one of the reasons our family occasionally ended up with pets was simply because people were giving them away. And my mom grew up on a farm, and I suspect that when you grow up on a farm, there's a lifelong perspective that tells you, oh yeah, there's room for stuff here, and it doesn't matter where here is. If it's a farm, your farming parents always had room for animals to hang around, and so the answer is just going to be yes. Yes, we can take some chickens. Yes, we'll take that hamster. We'll take that turtle, that poodle. Yes, we can handle that Saint Bernard. That happened in my life. It's only after the animals arrive that the reality of their presence can hit you with full force. I think the craziest animal arrival in my childhood home, well, apart from the dairy calf that really did not belong on a small lot in suburban San Diego, yes, we had a small bovine for a short while because my brother just happened to bring one home on a rope one summer day. But apart from that, I think the craziest animal arrival was a black cat. It walked into our yard, then right into our house and never left. It came of its own accord, and it arrived, this black cat, on Halloween Day and lived with our family for a very long 2 decades. I think it was an unintentional cat. I don't know how else to describe that cat. We did not intend for it to come. Well, today we are going to meet somebody who might sympathize with me in this business of animals that come without any forethought or reason or viable explanation. They just somehow land in your life, and for some reason you fail to say no. Our guest has quite a story to tell, and one word will be sufficient to convey the complication of the plot. The word is peacocks. Sean Flynn is with us. He has been a journalist for over 30 years. He's a correspondent for GQ. He's written a book titled Why Peacocks? An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird. Sean Flynn, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Marcus. Nice to be here.
Hey, you know, before we get into the story proper, just a few pragmatic things I want to know from you. I know how to catch a chicken. It's not always easy. But I would need help from somebody like you to learn how to catch a peacock or a peahen. I cannot imagine it's easy.
No, I still need help to do that. They are big birds. It can be done. I have a vet and some friends who just go in there and sort of manhandle them. I've always had to use a net, though. And I have to wait till they're very sick. They don't like to be handled much. There's a technique that my vet explained to me, it's basically you have to wait till night and climb up behind them on a ladder when they're up on their roost, and in a very swift motion, get one arm around their body to pin their wings and get your other hand around their ankles to pin their feet, and then back down the ladder in the dark, holding onto this big angry bird. I haven't done that yet.
Oh, you have not done the night ladder thing?
I have not. I've just waited till I got him into a corner and threw a net over him.
Now, what's the risk involved here, actually?
Well, they have, I didn't know this until I had them home, but peacocks are extremely well equipped for violence. On each of their legs, there's a spur, looks like a big shark's tooth behind their feet, and they've got very large talons. And I'm told once they get those big wings swinging, they can break a nose pretty quickly.
I'd never thought about that.
Neither had I, so I had to catch one.
It did not go well. It did go well. You succeeded?
I did succeed. He was very sick, unfortunately for him, fortunately for me, because it was easy to catch him. I didn't have a lot of fight in him, but it was still a net, and then just getting him bundled up. And you know, once you get him, once you get him corralled, they give up pretty easily.
Okay. Well, I think I might be able to do it with your help if you'd be willing to come. But I'm not going to choose to do that. I don't think you chose to have peacocks. Well, you must have chosen. You know, I still have one more pragmatic question before we get into the why you did this. How long do you have to keep a peacock once you have one?
Mythologically, they live forever. practically... I should be stuck with these things for a good 20 years, maybe a little longer. They're not short timers.
Did you know about their lifespan going into this?
Did not. I did not. I actually knew nothing about peacocks going into this, except they were very, very pretty. We just had an offer one day a friend of ours sent us a text and said, hey, do you guys want peacocks? And
I'd never considered it. That's really quite a friend.
Absolutely. I'd never considered it. But my wife, Louise, immediately said yes, which had nothing to do with peacocks or birds or looking after things, but with Flannery O'Connor. My wife is also a writer and editor, and she's a big fan of Flannery O'Connor, who very famously raised peacocks. So I think she had some vision of just a solitary bird sort of parading around the yard and looking all fabulous. But once she saw the peacocks in person, our role sort of switched. She saw how big they are and frankly, how much of a mess they can make, and changed her mind. I looked at these things and just thought they were spectacular. I'd never been up close to a peacock before. So it was out at a farm. We live on a piece of property that used to be a farm. It's not remotely rural. We live in the city, but we have an old farmhouse and an old barn and some chickens. So from the right angle, it sort of looks like we live on a farm, which is why we got this text about peacocks. The peacocks lived on a real farm, a horse farm, where our friend stabled her horse. And the woman who owned the farm was trying to get rid of them, because there was a lot of them and peacocks can be a little bit of a menace. None of which I knew. I just knew that I was up close to these big, beautiful birds and wanted to take some home. So that's how we ended up with peacocks.
Yeah. That word menace is lingering in my ear. How are they menacing?
Yeah. So whenever you come across a place with a lot of peacocks running wild, you know, a lot of suburban neighborhoods have, and there's some places in California and Florida, even up in Canada. You end up with, you know, half of the neighbors loving these beautiful birds and half of the neighbors wanting to kill them all. They're very, very noisy in the breeding season from about, in fact, you might hear them today, from about late April until late July. They're loud all the time, all day long. When they're roaming wild, they like to take dust baths in somebody's garden. They eat anything and everything. And the males, especially in the breeding season, are very aggressive towards other males. And when they see their reflection in cars, they tend to think that's another male. So they've been known to do a fair amount of damage to people's cars. Also, they like to roost on cars. And I mentioned those big talons. They can do a number on your paint.
Yeah, the menacing thing is absolutely clear to me. Now we can move on to my next concern. Yeah, okay. You have written something of an explanation in the form of a memoir for why you actually went down this road and didn't back out of that road. You persevered. You went forward, and you still have them today. And there's some kind of meaning in this for you. We've kind of started with the question of their appeal. Would you elaborate on the appeal of these birds for you personally, if your wife lost some of her enthusiasm?
Yeah. So it really did just start with looking at them. I mean, it's a friend of mine said that she was paraphrasing Winston Churchill, just saying that the outside of these birds was good for the inside of her. And I completely get that. It's from the beginning, I would spend a fair amount of time in their pen with them. Mine are penned, by the way, so they're not a neighborhood menace. I would spend, you know, a fair amount of time in there, not, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes a day. And they're very, they're social in their way. These aren't birds that are going to, you know, like the chickens will just flap up into your lap, but these they're curious, especially the hens. They sort of interact with me in a way, you know, they all eat out of my hand and they all, you know, come running up to see what I've got when I go in there. And they just became sort of, easy creatures to talk to when I was working out some of my own, work stuff. So I've been a writer for years and years and years. And usually I write about, a lot of crime, a lot of disaster, a lot of death. And I've been trying to separate out my professional life from my home life. And it's not, you know, when you're writing a story about, you know, a mass murder in New Zealand, that's not something I want to talk about in front of my kids. So I would, you know, wander off someplace and it's, you get a lot of thinking done when you can talk out loud. And I did a lot of talking out loud to some peacocks and they seemed to enjoy it. usually because they're just waiting for blueberries. But it was very helpful for me to sort of separate, to set up sort of a home life that was different from my work life, and to keep these different silos, and having these big, beautiful birds that were, you know, oddly therapeutic to talk with was a lot of help.
You could actually confide things in the peacock you wouldn't confide with somebody else.
Yes, because they don't tell anybody. So, and it's, you know, it's because they're captive. They can't wander away. And I don't think they're terribly bright, but they do a pretty good show of looking like they're paying attention.
It's not easy to talk to an animal a lot. I mean, I can talk to the cat and say something kind of in a desultory fashion, but this sounds like very important conversation you're having with the birds.
Yes, although I wouldn't actually call it a conversation since there is only one side to it. This is throughout all of this, I've had to make clear that I haven't lost my marbles or anything. I'm fully aware that they are birds and they're not conversing with me. I've always found it helpful when I'm working out a lot of complicated stuff to say it out loud. And if I'm wandering around the house, I don't know if the kids are going to overhear me. And if you know, people think you're a little bonkers when you wander around talking about some of the stuff I talk about.
Yeah.
So it was a nice little place to sit down and work some stuff out.
So here's the thing. You've established that they have a visual appeal, that they're magnificent, yeah. That you can unburden your soul talking at them, if not to them. But you could do that with a gerbil, you know? They're kind of cute. You could do that with any number of – there's something more powerful, I suspect, about these peacocks because you already had chickens.
Yep. The chickens would – you know, the chickens are free range, so they would wander away from me. there is it, – it's – these are – you know, for thousands and thousands of years, peacocks have been these birds of myth and wonder. They look like something that was made up, in some ancient myth. You know, they don't seem to make any sense. These big, beautiful trains seem to serve no functional purpose. They're an unreal color, this blue. So there's just something inherently exotic and impossible and fantastical and almost magical about them. And, you know, even now, years later, when Carl and Mr. Pickle throw up those trains, it's mesmerizing. I never get tired of watching it. There's just something. I feel almost silly saying it, but there's something almost magical about them.
Yeah, that's unlike a journalist to be using that word magical and just leaving.
I know.
You know, you're supposed to follow the story where it leads, and you really have. You've taken this to the mythology of India. You go back to the Greek mythology. How do those myths inform your experience beyond you say, oh, well, that's kind of an interesting little tidbit from an encyclopedia?
Yeah. One thing I noticed that really sort of stuck with me as I kept reading through all this stuff. So the kind of birds I have, these India blues, they're native to the subcontinent, but they've been global citizens for thousands of years. They've been traded since the time of Solomon. As these birds moved west, and the mythology grew up around them, it became more and more, the birds became more and more a repository for human foibles and human flaws. We project onto these birds this idea that they are vain, that they are arrogant. None of which is really true. I mean, they're a bird, you know, they're no more vain or arrogant than a sparrow. But it became a way to explain things about human, you know, Aesop used them repeatedly as a stand-in for arrogance and vanity and pride and the downfall of pride and ego. And it stuck with me reading through all these old stories and then reading through the real life stories. These birds did become symbols of the ultra wealthy and the ostentatious. And they would be, you know, they were imported into California by a very ostentatious character. And yet we were still projecting upon them our own human foibles when they really are just birds. I don't find Mr. Pickle to be any more arrogant than our pug. Reading the stories about the birds tells you much more about the human condition than it does about the birds themselves.
Yeah. It's a reflection. We see a false reflection of ourselves in them, I guess, or
a true
false reflection.
Yes. Yes. Right. That's an excellent way to put it.
You know, I want to learn about Mr. Pickle. That's the most curious name, and we're going to do that. That's the name of one of your birds, or we'll have to find out. And I also want to hear about peacock surgery that you've been involved in. We're going to do it after a short break here. We are visiting with Sean Flynn. He's a journalist, and his new book is titled Why Peacocks? An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird. Stay with us for more Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have a peacock owner with us by the name of Sean Flynn. Sean has been a journalist for over 30 years and a correspondent for GQ, and I almost called him Sean Penn, and that's not his name. But Sean Flynn, Why Peacocks is your book, An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird, and you named one of them not Penn, but Pickle. Mr. Pickle, why?
So that was they all ended up with ridiculous names. We brought these three birds home, two hens and two cocks. And my wife, Louise, has always had a thing for sort of old-fashioned hen names. So she decided right off the bat that the hen was going to be called Ethel. it was which seemed to be a fine, sturdy name for a very sturdy bird. And then we just named the other one Carl because. So the last one that was left, he was a full-grown male. This was called a black-shouldered India blue. He's got these beautiful blue-black wings. And he had his full train sprouted out and everything else. And it was my youngest son, Emmett, announced very confidently that his name was Mr. Pickle. Of course, we all thought it was Mr. Pickles. And he was adamant that it was just Pickle because there's only one of him. And it didn't make any sense until you looked at it through the eyes of a nine-year-old. When a peacock's train is all folded up and sort of dragging behind him, it's about the shape of a pickle, a big giant pickle. And the eyes in the train sort of look like the bumps on a pickle. So in his very logical nine-year-old mind, clearly this was a Mr. Pickle.
Which of the birds became ill? Was that Mr. Pickle or another?
No, that was Carl. Carl was a yearling when we brought him home and perhaps not the brightest bird. I just found him laying out in the hay one day, very listless. As it happens, one of the best avian vets in the country, possibly the world, lives about 2 miles from me, has his practice there. So I took in some samples to Dr. Burkett, who did some quick lab work and was able to tell me that Carl's immune system was not properly working and that I would have to bring him in, which is when he explained to me the whole elaborate process of catching a bird, and I went and got a net and threw it over Carl. It turns out that Carl had eaten a copper grommet that he scratched out of the dirt. And because he had a stomach ache from that, he ate all sorts of other stuff, including some lead, some nickel. It was awful. He had three kinds of metal poisoning and a stomach full of rocks. So it's Dr. Burkett was able to cure or pull the heavy metals out of his bloodstream just with some drugs. But then he had to get all the rocks out of his stomach, big rocks that weren't going to, you know, pass out the other end. So Carl had a couple of surgeries, one of which I stumbled upon and sort of forced myself into an assistant's position. It was quite a fascinating thing to see this big giant bird all gassed up and splayed out on his back with a hole cut through his crop, sort of at the base of his neck. It's where they grind up food when they swallow it before it goes to their stomach. Dr. Burkett had cut a big hole through there and had run a tube down into Carl's stomach and then flushed it out with a lot of water, and then spent hours with a little tiny pair of grabbers going in there and pulling rocks pulling rocks out one by one. It was it was quite an experience. I'd never gotten to assist in a surgery, let alone a bird surgery.
Any little beads of sweat on your brow?
I don't think so. You know, weirdly enough, I was kind of giddy about this whole thing. It was just another great story I was going to be able to tell the kids. Carl's sick, but I helped save him. which, in fairness, I really did nothing except stand there and watch. But I convinced myself I was assisting.
Did the vet wag his finger at you and say, keep this bird away from those stones?
You know, he did not. Dr. Burkett's been very kind to me. You know, he figured out early on when I first went to see him for some advice that when it came to birds, I was a bit of a dope. That I just brought home two peacocks and a peahen, which, by the way, is a terrible, terrible combination.
I would think so, yes.
It wasn't good. So I think he's always had a little bit of sympathy for me. And, you know, the thing about birds is, and this is the other thing that's been great about him, is he's the one who's reminded me all the time that these are just birds. You know, they're really no different than the chickens. They're just bigger and prettier. So he's been nice to me.
Well, okay, if he says these are just birds, was there a hint in that you don't always have to save a bird?
Yes, absolutely. And he was not Louise and I have taken some extraordinary measures for pets before, and that's the thing. These guys are pets. If I was a peacock farmer, Carl would have been a pretty basic cost benefit analysis, and he would not have come out on the proper side of that.
Yeah. Have you lost chickens in the past?
We have. Yeah. So at the time we had two barred rocks, and they both were taken out by a fox. And since then we've had more chickens, and you know, Dr. Burkett's put one down for us. She had a prolapse, and you know, this kind of happens.
Yeah, you realize, don't you, that after you have named them, it's a little bit more difficult to actually eat them for dinner.
Oh, it's brutal. It's brutal. You know, I'm very much a food chain hypocrite. I'm not a hunter, but I eat a lot of meat. But yeah, once you come out and find those headless chickens in the yard, not headless chickens, headless Comet and Snowball, it makes it a little hard to eat chicken for a while.
Do you realize we had a Comet, a chicken?
Did you?
You and I should bond over that. That's just remarkable.
So why was your chicken named Comet?
Well,
it's a very strange name for a chicken.
There are very strange names for our chickens. My young children named them. One of them was named Moose, which I thought was a little odd. But the strangest of all was Oaken Quiver, like oaken, like an adjective, OAKEN, Oaken Quiver. I don't think they make quivers out of oak, but that was the name of this bird. We've had some strange names.
That's an awesome name for a chicken. You can name a whole breed that.
If it's a Plymouth barred rock named Oaken Quiver, you got a mouthful right there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's get back to your story. You paid a hefty price to have this bird saved. And have you ever regretted that? I mean, that can't have been cheap surgery.
No, it was not cheap surgery. And Carl was very, very lucky in that there was a bit of a cash, an unexpected cash windfall that made him sort of budget neutral. It was not inexpensive. And no, I haven't regretted it. You know, it's I'm not sure I would do it again. And certainly if you told me at the beginning that, hey, bring this bird home and it's going to cost you this amount of dollars, I never would have brought the bird home. But at that point, you know, he's a pet, and yeah, I'm not a farmer. These aren't livestock. they're pets. And people do a lot of strange things with their pets. And we spent more saving a cat once.
So if the vet tells you that it's just a bird, would he be persuaded by a book such as yours where you're going on this unlikely search for meaning? Would a vet clue in to your MO in life with peacocks here if it's just a bird? You're actually looking for and presumably have found some kind of meaning in this magnificent creature, and the vet might not get that.
Well, I don't want to mischaracterize what Dr. Burkett said. He told me that, but it was more in the context of telling me to stop looking so hard for something that it really is just a bird. And Burkett loves birds. You know, this is a guy who decided when he was 14 years old, he was going to be a bird surgeon for no other reason than he thought these are God's creatures and maybe I can help them. It was a very strange little epiphany that he had. And he obviously adores birds, but they're also they're his patients. He's also a breeder. So they're more of a commodity to him. But Yes, I think he would definitely be persuaded. You know, he deals with bird owners all the time. And while it seems very strange to me, outrageous really, to be paying the kind of money I was paying for bird surgery, he deals with people who pay that all the time. A very good surgeon, by the way. He's terrific at it. He understands the attachment people have with their pets. But I think when he was telling me that they're just birds, it was more of a gentle reminder to me that they're not actually magical. there's nothing mythological about them. They're just a big, pretty bird.
Does that steal your thunder for a book like this? I mean, I come from the background of literature and poetry, and I am fairly convinced that one should not give up on that magical aspect of finding meaning in things that, for one thing, they're alive. You know, that this is a life form. This is meaningful.
See, and that's what I think where you really get down to it. It is meaningful, and I find a lot of meaning in these birds, but I also find meaning in my chickens, you know, in my pug. It's in all these different things, and it's a peacock can't help the way it looks, if that makes sense. I always felt, you know, you read enough of these fables and myths, and you keep hearing about how arrogant and awful the peacock is, and it's not his fault he's got these big, pretty feathers. it's he's just a bird, and that's the way he was made. And you know, I'm sure a chicken thinks it's fabulously beautiful too. So that's really sort of what I was working out.
Yeah. There's something, though, about the visual aspect here that you point to, which has to do with the incapacity of some predators to even see that beauty, to even see that variation in color. The iridescence is lost on maybe, I don't know, a fox or maybe an India, a jaguar or something.
And that's sort of the base level of ignorance that I was working from. You know, I look at these birds, as I think most people do, if they consider it, it seems to have this enormous, worthless appendage, you know, feathers that are you know, longer than its body hanging off the back, which should make it difficult to fly. It doesn't. They fly just fine. And does look like a big, giant advertisement. In fact, it is a big, giant advertisement. The whole reason this thing exists is to entice hens to reproduce. And yet I didn't know anything about feline ophthalmology. It's jaguars, big cats, you know, the animals most likely to want to eat a peacock. They don't see the world the same way that we do. Birds don't see the world the same way that we do. Their eye structure is different. With cats, they have a slightly lesser eye structure, so they don't see as many colors as we do. So a peacock strain probably just blends into the underbrush.
Yeah. Well, the real telling thing for me wouldn't necessarily be if you ultimately found sufficient meaning in these animals to keep them, and you still got them. How long have you had them now, by the way?
It'll be 4 years come July.
Okay. I think the proof in the eating of this pudding is whether or not Louise ever came around to find meaning.
I don't think she's found meaning in them, but I think she knows that they're good for me. In fact, she does know that. So, you know, we there are more than we started with, because you know, the two boys and one girl was not a smart combination. But there's only five there now, and we discuss every now and again, especially during breeding season, that maybe it's time to move on. And we may, in fact, do that only because of the noise, and really only the noise. She has never spent as much time with them as I have. But she is still sort of blown away by this fabulous display. You know, when those feathers go up and they start making that rattling noise, it really is just breathtaking.
And were it not for Flannery O'Connor, she might not be so sympathetic.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And the kids? The kids love them?
No, not particularly. You know, they're teenagers now. They've got other stuff going on. You know, all the animals have sort of fallen to me, except for the dog. So, but yeah, all the birds, the chickens, the peacocks, those are all kind of my my responsibility now.
Well, to conclude our conversation, I just want to be very hypothetical here for a moment, if you'll indulge me, which is, suppose you do offload the peacocks. I don't know how you're going to do that. You know, you could tell other people that they're quiet and then pass them on. But there's some ethical thing there. I want to know, if you have these birds disappear from your life, where are you going to go next for magnificence?
Oof. Oh, boy, I don't want to think about that right now.
You know you will.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose we'd first start with some more chickens. You know, I've always wanted an alpaca, but I'm not making much progress with that one.
Check with Louise first.
Exactly. She's not budging on the alpaca.
Sean Flynn, I've had a great time getting to know you and your story. And what a book. It's a remarkable piece. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, Marcus, thank you. I appreciate it.
Sean Flynn with us. He's been a journalist for over 30 years. He's a correspondent for GQ, and his book is titled Why Peacocks? An Unlikely Search for Meaning in the World's Most Magnificent Bird.
It's easy to find wonder in a peacock or humor in a giraffe, but finding wonder in the lowly mole? That might take someone who spent years in the fields and hedges catching them for a living before he saw the light and vowed to leave them alone henceforth. We'll talk to that man when Constant Wonder returns in just 1 minute. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Wandering around the hedges and fields of England, Mark Hamer was a mole catcher. He's since retired and reformed, as he would say, having seen the error of his ways and taken a vow to leave moles to their own devices. He's the author of How to Catch a Mole, Wisdom from a Life Lived in Nature. Marcus Smith spoke with him about his previous vocation and what he learned mucking around with moles. We join the conversation here with the question, was he good at catching moles?
I like to think that I was very good at it. I have caught many, many hundreds of moles. I've never, ever had a mole that I've been after get away from me. Am I proud to say that? I'm not sure, but that's the fact.
How did you get so down close to the earth that you would even know what moles are?
Oh, that's a very, very long story. When I was 16 years old, my mother died and my father threw me out of the house, surplus to requirements. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I outlived my welcome, sleeping on friends' couches and that kind of thing. I couldn't afford to find anywhere to live or to rent. So I started walking, and I started walking in the countryside, and I lived in the countryside and lived rough, sleeping under hedges and against dry stone walls. And I did that for nearly 2 years.
I have to interrupt because rough sleeping is kind of a British expression. You're talking about being you're being homeless.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But in those days, the word homeless was not a word that we used really. I mean, I was what we would call a tramp and perhaps what you would call a bum. We didn't have the homeless problems here in this country that we have today. And it was a lifestyle that after a short period of time, I grew very comfortable with and, as I say, lived it for nearly 2 years.
And somehow that led to an acquaintance with Mother Earth, with soil, with creatures?
Yeah. Well, every night I'd walk every day. I was walking along next to rivers and canals and through small villages and fields and byways and that kind of thing. And every night I would have to find somewhere to sleep, and that would often be underneath a hedge. And when you sleep underneath a hedge every night and you have no artificial means of illumination, when the sun goes down, you're finding somewhere to sleep and the birds are singing above you and the blackbirds are singing and you hear them go to sleep. And I went to sleep with them and kind of woke up with them in the morning at the same time, really. I kind of developed a distance, but I suppose quite a loving relationship with them. I became part of that whole cycle, really, of just wandering along and living in the hedges.
I would imagine this is a sword that cuts two ways. On the one direction, you could say, indeed, that's a hard life. The other direction, yeah, you could say, is there something idyllic about it at all?
It was indeed, it does cut both ways. There were times when it was absolutely terrifying. There were times, more than one occasion, where I hadn't eaten for several days and I wondered if I was going to survive for much longer. And other times that I still look back on as perhaps the most beautiful things that I've ever seen. I remember a time waking up by a riverbank and there was a fog, and I opened my eyes and I couldn't see a thing. It was daylight and it was glowing. And as I stood up, I came up through the fog and could look down upon it. And I walked along and there was a wake behind me as I moved. And that's something that would have been beyond my imagining. And I can still see it to this very day, walking along, turning around and seeing the wake in the fog that I made. Some very, very beautiful experiences, but also some deeply, deeply lonely ones as well.
I can quite easily connect the dots from that kind of an existence to gardening, because you're already outdoors. Yeah. Professional gardener at some point.
Yes. I mean, I eventually found a home and I settled down and I worked on the railway for quite a while and then went off to art school. And I worked in a chicken shop at night and paid my way through art school. And I got jobs in offices and that kind of thing. And I was never happy. I needed to be outdoors. And eventually the art school training of painting and the being outdoors kind of coincided. And I ended up sort of planting flowers and working with flowers in gardens, and life kind of came around full circle, really, and took me outside again, but with a new knowledge and a new understanding and a different kind of view of the world.
So are moles then a mortal enemy of flowers?
Not of flowers, but they are of lawns. They will dig under flower beds and flowers will be upturned, but there's no difficulty to come along and just push the flower, push the plant back into the ground again, and little harm is done. But they are definitely an enemy of lawns and the people who like nice, flat, mown lawns. Absolutely. They are detested creatures by those people.
So I have said already that you did not prepare a how-to manual. I could get that from the internet if I want to know how to trap. But and we've established that you're very good at that, and I trust you on that. But what would moles teach us beyond management of a property?
Well, for me, quite a number of things, really. They're very isolated creatures. They're very solitary creatures. If a mole meets another mole, they will fight, and one of them, if not both of them, will ultimately die because of that, because they have a very curious blood system that in which they kind of bleed to death quite easily. But they kind of stay in one place as well. They have this network of tunnels. They never move anywhere apart from the mating season and come back. They're bizarre, interesting kind of creatures. But what they can teach us, I don't know, really. I don't know how to answer that.
But you have spent endless time observing them, probably studying them. I think studying is the fair word here.
Yes. I mean, since I was a boy, really, I mean, sitting on sort of hillsides, watching them go up a hillside as the weather changes, as they or the worms that they feed upon realize that there is wet weather coming and they go to higher ground, and you see mole hills start to appear further up the hills. And, you know, watching them for many, many years, even before I started going catching them, really, I was kind of quite curious about them. They're very strange creatures. And it's, you know, when you see these little hills just appear out of nowhere and that don't seem to make any sense. It was an interesting thing.
Well, you describe them as being isolated, but that's in the context of society with other moles. They're certainly not isolated from soil or the roots of the grasses or the air or the rains that fall. And so in terms of thinking about a mole's existence as a creature in the company of other things, that's kind of social.
Well, yes, they don't have much of a relationship with the things that they come across. They tend to eat most of them.
Not a healthy relationship, except for the mole.
Well, healthy for the mole and probably healthy for the population of various bugs and beetles that fall into their tunnels as well. You know, the worm population is a good and healthy population in a good piece of soil, and it can stand a few moles being there. They're quite antisocial creatures, really, but they're they're quite fascinating as well. Fascinating creatures to look at and to hold and to just observe and to get down into their tunnels. I mean, I've spent many times on my knees with my hands inside their tunnels and sort of figuring out what it is they're doing and why they're doing it. And it's been quite a fascinating thing to do, fascinating life.
The role of stealth in your former work of catching moles, yeah, they can sense humans from afar off.
Many a time I've walked out a field and I've looked into a field and seen mole hills all over it and spotted out the corner of my eye a little bit of movement, seen a mole hill and the mole moving. And I've been like, you know, hundreds of yards away from this thing. And as soon as I take a step, the mole freezes. It knows that I'm there. You know, they know where I am. And that kind of makes catching them quite difficult because they know that I'm right above their tunnel system, digging into their tunnel system and putting traps in for them. So you have to kind of outwit them in a way, you know. You have to be one step ahead of them. But yeah, they're very sensitive. They're sensitive to air pressure. They're sensitive to vibrations in the soil. They, you know, they're but not to light so much. But yeah, they do know that I'm there.
Your presence in the life of moles, it matters to them just in terms of their safety. But their presence in your lives has been important enough for you to actually write a book and put them in the title. Are you trying to elevate the humble mole?
I think I had such a strong relationship with them. And as I was writing, initially I was writing, I just wanted to write a little, just a very small book about what my day was actually like, of going into the fields at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning when there was frost about and catching the moles and what it felt like. I wanted to write a kind of instruction book, but also a reflection on what it felt like to do that. And it's kind of developed from that point onwards. I'm sorry, I kind of forgot what your question was there.
Well, it all just goes to motive. As I say goodbye to you, yeah, I want to say, first of all, it's a lovely piece. It's a beautiful book. And it seems improbable as a book in some ways. Just comment, yeah, on the improbability of somebody elevating, calling attention, putting a spotlight on a creature that, yeah, doesn't like the light.
Very much so. But also, as I was writing it, the parallels came out about my own life as well, you know, about the fact that I had been out there in the countryside on my own and completely isolated. And I kind of, as I was writing the book, felt almost a new kinship with the mole, really, a kind of a realization that our lives were not too dissimilar from each other's.
Marcus Smith there speaking with Mark Hamer, the author of How to Catch a Mole, Wisdom from a Life Lived in Nature. We're going to finish an hour of wonder moving from the ostentatious peacock and the humble mole to one of the grandest living things in the world by any measure. We're talking about redwoods, and one redwood in particular, which has been given the name Hyperion, and whose location is known to only a handful of people. Marcus Smith spoke with best-selling author Richard Preston about the secret of Hyperion. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
Hyperion is a spire, and it's rather young for its age. It's like a young teenager sprouting up, like a young basketball player. And as these trees get older, they tend to go bald. They lose their tops just the way we do, we humans. Also, their bark turns from red to gray, just the way we go gray. And they get gnarly looking. They get stouter, just as we do. So Hyperion is a young redwood. It's a beautiful tree. The exact location of Hyperion has been kept successfully a secret. And my understanding is that not more than about a dozen people know the actual location of Hyperion.
Well, you just said it's a beautiful tree, and that seems to indicate that you're among them who have seen it.
I was a member of the four-person climbing team that made the first ascent of Hyperion a few months after it was discovered in 2006.
Take us up there. You've got to take us up there.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's some tree. So the base of the tree is about 14, 15 feet across, which makes it a modest-sized redwood, at least in terms of girth. So Stephen Sillett, Marie Antoine were the lead climbers, and then I and my climbing partner, a guy named James Spickler, we were the second team to go up. So we first had to hike our gear into this through this absolutely impossible rainforest. It was a very difficult hike, and we had to crawl under a huge pile of giant redwood logs. It's like caving to get into this valley. We got to the base of the tree. We set up our gear. And then Steve Sillett has a high-powered bow, a compound bow, and he shot an arrow up into Hyperion, went up about 200 feet or more. And the arrow is trailing a thin line. The arrow comes back down to the ground, and you now have a kind of thread-like line going up into the crown of this tree. And they use that line to drag a rope all the way up to the top of the tree to where the arrow went and then down to the ground again. They tie one end of the rope to the ground, and then you put very sophisticated climbing rig. You put on a harness. You use these rope ascenders. These are complicated devices that climbers use for climbing straight up a rope. And you get on that rope, and you start climbing. So Sillett and Marie Antoine made it to the top. And you can only talk with people on a walkie-talkie radio. Shouting is absolutely impossible. And when you get up into one of the crowns of one of these giant trees, you can't see the ground. You can't see the sky. You're somewhere between heaven and earth in a labyrinth of branches. And the branches typically have a lot of things growing on them, even small trees growing on the branches of these giant redwoods. But hanging gardens of moss, beds of soil. Some of these branches, the branch itself may be 1,000 years old. And then over 1,000 years, dust that comes down out of the atmosphere lands on the branch, and it will accumulate very slowly until there can be up to 2 to 3 feet of dirt called canopy soil sitting on top of the branch. And then the dirt is filled with living things. So you get up into these trees. So anyway, my partner and I, we climbed below Sillett and Antoine, and we were measuring the trees as we went along. We had a tape line, and every 10 meters we stopped. Actually, every 10 feet we stopped and measured the girth of the tree. This was to get an estimate of the actual volume and mass of this amazing living thing. And meanwhile, we're talking on the walkie-talkie with the lead climbers, and Marie Antoine said, at one point she broke in and she said, "Oh my goodness, I'm seeing ants here. These ants are like no ant I've ever seen before. They're golden in color, and they're only in the top of the tree, nowhere else." And we talked about it later, and we figured that that was almost certainly an unidentified species of ant that lives in the tallest redwoods that's never been seen or noticed by science before, an ant that doesn't have a name. And we couldn't even be sure that that ant lives anywhere except maybe in that one tiny little valley. Ant species can, you know, they can occupy very small spaces. So it was just one of those things where, you know, we found something that had never been seen before in the world's tallest tree, and that ant has never been seen again. Steve Sillett and Marie Antoine have climbed Hyperion a number of times. They climb it once a year to measure it, and they've never seen those ants again.
The rarity of what goes on up in these tree canopies, that leads me to wonder about the differences between, say, the life forms in soil on the ground and life forms found up in the canopy soil. Do you feel like you don't want to tread on that stuff?
Yes. The canopy structures, the living things up there, are as delicate as a coral reef. And it's really like a coral reef in the air. As you go higher and higher in these giant redwoods, the species of life that you see change, the life forms change. So the trees are very stratified, just the way a coral reef is stratified. As you go deeper and deeper, you see different kinds of corals in deeper water and different species of fish. So when you get up into the redwoods, you see mostly things that are rather small, because small living things are the almost everything that lives on the planet is small, including many species of bacteria, worms, tiny arthropods. We and the redwoods are giant life forms, as that goes. So when the scientists get up into those trees, they began digging around in the soil, and they found wandering salamanders. That's a species. Nobody really knows what they do in the redwoods, but it has been established that they never touch the ground. But these salamanders live their entire life cycle up in the branches of the redwoods. And they also found giant pink earthworms of an unknown, unnamed species. No one knows how these earthworms in the sky got there. They don't know what the worms are doing there or how they carry on their lives. They just find them there. The canopy soil also has these hanging gardens of ferns. These gardens are vast. The ferns are attached to the limbs, the giant limbs of the trees. They grow in soil, and they accumulate in masses of many tons. Can be 250 feet above the ground, 25 stories above the ground. You find yourself in a lost garden. Now, these structures are incredibly delicate. It's estimated that for some of the mosses and the lichens that occur on these branches, that it takes a minimum of 600 years to form one of these aerial gardens. And if you go through just a kick of a boot, can knock 600 years worth of life off a branch. So we had to be exquisitely careful as we were moving around. And Steve Sillett and Marie Antoine will, when they get into very delicate areas, they take their boots off and they climb barefoot. You wear soft clothing. You wear boots that have flexible, soft soles. And you never reach up and grab something without knowing exactly what you're grabbing, because you might be grabbing some beautiful structure that's hundreds of years old.
Marcus Smith there speaking with Richard Preston, best-selling author of, among other books, The Wild Trees, A Story of Passion and Daring. Tomorrow on Constant Wonder, a capsizing cruise ship, a frightened crew, and brave music performers off the stormy coast of Africa. This is not the Titanic. No, no, this shipwreck has a happy ending. And you won't believe who does the rescuing. That's tomorrow on Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We've enjoyed having you along today. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.